This is East and Ink. Today we present Richard Brockman reading from his book Life After Death, Surviving Suicide. Brockman, an expert in genetics, epigenetics, and the biology of attachment, chronicles his evolution from a child overwhelmed by trauma to a man who has struggled to reclaim his past. Here is Richard Brockman.
Forward, two stories. I was born on December 15th. That is a narrative truth. I was born 7 years, 2 months, 2 days earlier on October 13th. That is a biological fact. Story has narrative, story has biology. Life After Death tells two stories. One is the story of my mother's suicide, the devastation that her suicide brought to our family and to me. The other is the story of story itself, how story is biologically laid down, assembled, expanded, how it comes apart, dies, regenerates. One is narrative, the other biologic. The narrative has beginning, middle, and end. The biology has birth, growth, and death. When my mother killed herself on December 15th, she ended the biology of her life. When my mother killed herself on December 15th, she ended the narrative of mine. Her suicide ended the narrative of who I was, the narrative of who I wanted to be. When my mother killed herself, she ended the narrative of her 7 year, 2 month, 2 day old boy. How does one continue a narrative when all has been lost? One doesn't. One can't. The narrative can't go on because narrative is only part of the story. Story has a biologic as well as a narrative arc. The biology of my story begins with a synapse. A synapse connects neurons. When neurons connect, memory is formed. When memories overlap, they form assemblies that connect various parts of the brain. When various parts of the brain connect, story begins. Thus, when asked, "Who are you?" one might say, "I am an adventurer," or "I am a conquistador," or if asked by a hookah-smoking caterpillar, one might reply, as Alice did, I hardly know, sir, at present. At least I knew who I was when I got up this morning. And from that response, one would surmise that since that morning, Alice's story had been challenged, perhaps overwhelmed, and was disorganizing. Being an assembly, story can be put together. Being an assembly, it can come apart. And when the biology of assembly comes apart, story comes apart. So there is a biological reason why Alice did not know who she was. There is a biologic reason why overwhelming experience disorganizes narrative. There is a biologic reason why my mother's suicide overwhelmed. Overwhelming experience assaults the biological organization of story, which puts the integrative action of narrative at risk. I hardly know, sir, at least at present. Like Alice, I too knew who I was when I got up this morning. But by that afternoon, my story had come apart. My sense of time destroyed. My narrative had collapsed. In order for narrative to be reorganized, biology must be restored. Only then can narrative progress. Life After Death tells two stories. One is the narrative of my mother's suicide. The other is the biology of story itself. To understand how overwhelming trauma affects story, one must understand how story is born, assembled, how it grows, dies, and how, with time, work, love, and the recreation of safety, it can be restored. One story, the story of who you are, of who I am, is both an abstract truth and a biologic fact. I was born on December 15th. That is a narrative truth. I was born 7 years, 2 months, 2 days earlier on October 13th. That is a biologic fact. Life After Death tells two stories. That's the foreword to the book, basically explaining the structure that's going to occur of going between narrative and biology, narrative and biology. And that was the last thing I wrote, actually. And that was because my editor, Jeanette Seaver, who was here, said, "You've got to explain what you're doing, because otherwise no one's going to get it. Or it's going to be difficult. You're making it more difficult for your audience, for your readership, to get it if you don't explain what you're doing." So with your help and Alice in Wonderland's help, I explained to a certain degree what I was about to do, which was to tell two stories. Chapter 1, quote, "Those who seek revenge must dig two graves," end quote. "What are you thinking?" the psychiatrist asked, his patient lying supine on the couch, as he took a drag on his Parliament cigarette, leaned back in his worn leather chair, exhaled. She stared at the ceiling. A thin puff of smoke drifted above and dissolved. Her hand moved toward the wall. There was another long pause, another puff, another, "What are you thinking?" After which she uttered the start of a thought that just hung in the air as fragile as smoke. "I can't. I. He took another drag. And when she went no further, he repeated, "What are you thinking?" crossing and uncrossing his legs. But there was another question, one he never asked, a question that should have been addressed not to her, but to himself. What am I going to do about her thinking? And the failure to ask that question is why I hold him guilty of murder, and why my life has been lived seeking justice. Chapter 3. I opened the door to enter the house, and my mother was there, searching the hall closet. When she heard the door, she turned and shielded her eyes, as if she couldn't see through the glare of sunlight from the street. She stared at me for a moment, as if trying to make sense of what she saw, then said, "Why aren't you in school? Aren't you supposed to be in school? Aren't you supposed to be? I know, but they said, and so, who said?" She took her dark green jacket from the jacket. She wore that jacket a lot, and her green hat. "I got a shot." "A what?" "In my arm. Get your coat." She put on her green jacket. I was already wearing my coat. "They should have told me." "But Mommy, never mind," she said, straightening her hat. She wore her dark green jacket and hat when it was cold. It was October. It was cold. "They said a piece of polio was in the shot. I don't know what piece, but it hurt a lot. A lot of kids cried. I didn't, but it was close. I wasn't sure what polio was, but I was pretty sure it was bad because it hurt. Mommy, what's polio?" I asked as she went out the door, across the yard, into the garage. She walked fast. She used to play tennis. I used to think she played pretty good. "When I get older, I want to play." "Mommy," I called. It was hard to keep up. Every kid got a shot, every kid except Alan Fisher, because he was allergic to eggs. I didn't see what eggs had to do with it. I followed her into the garage. My bike was there against the wall. I loved my bike. I loved it a lot. I had a blue and it had blue and red streamers, and if you pinned baseball cards in the wheels, and it hit the spokes and made lots of noise. "Get in the car." "Where are we going?" "We had a car. It was a Cadillac. I hated that car. When we drove along the street, I'd slink down. I didn't want kids to know that my father had a Cadillac. I didn't think we were rich, but my father had a Cadillac. So I guess he didn't care what others thought, or maybe he did. The very day I saw it in the driveway, I asked my father what a Cadillac was doing in the driveway. A car he must have known I hated. "I'd never buy a Mercedes," he said, "not after what they did." "What did they do?" I asked. "And anyway, it's better than a Mercedes." My father was a Jew. I guess that meant I was one too. "It's a beautiful car." I hated the car. "Where are we going?" I asked once more as we backed out of the driveway. "Mommy!" Once she hit the stone post, my father got so mad I thought he was going to tear the post right off with his bare hands. "I have an appointment." "What for?" We drove down Falmouth Street, then up onto Orient Avenue, onto Shore Parkway, past Sheepshead Bay, where sometimes I go fishing, off the blue wooden bridge. Porgies and flounders were fish that I never caught. I once caught a fish that was black. I threw it back because I hate to eat fish, and it was slimy. "Mommy!" We drove past Ebinger's Bakery, where she went when it was my birthday. I love presents, but mostly I love Ebinger's cake. I wanted a dog. I got a bike. I also wanted a bike, so that was okay. "Mommy!" She just drove. She drove past the turn to Neptune Avenue in Coney Island. We drove down a street where my mother said I should never ride my bike. And then she turned onto the Belt Parkway. "Where are we going?" She just drove. All I wanted to know was, "Richard, sit back." She just drove. And then she turned onto Ocean Boulevard, and there it was, dead ahead, and suddenly I knew where we were going. In 1927, Ivan Pavlov, okay, and then there's a long spiel the author goes into about Ivan Pavlov and the nature of conditioned reflexes, and sort of setting up something. And that is, I have a feeling most of you probably know what conditioned what Pavlov's work was about. And I'm obviously not reading, I'm just paraphrasing here. When Pavlov took a dog and put them in a box, and then they rang a bell, and then they gave a shock. And so after a while, the dog would get it that you hear the shock, and you can anticipate you're getting a shock. So that the conditioned reflex is that the animal will hear, or the mammal. Actually, it goes all the way back to invertebrates, but you hear the shot, you hear the bell, and you anticipate the shock, so you start manifesting all of the behavior. There's another form of conditioned reflex where it's about space, where you take a dog and you put it in a box, and in that box, the animal gets shocked. So it begins to fear the box itself. So if you put in the box, the animal will react as if it's going to get shocked. So it's called place recognition. Place recognition, a form of conditioned learning, requires that so the first form of shock requires the amygdala. The second part requires the hippocampus, which is they're both part of your temporal lobes.
This is East End Inc. We are listening to Richard Brockman reading from his book, Life After Death, Surviving Suicide.
Conditioned learning to place requires that the hippocampus, also part of the temporal lobe, be intact. I guess my hippocampus was intact because when I saw the Dime Savings Bank of Brooklyn, I froze. The Dime Savings Bank of Brooklyn, the one with the clock where Alan Fisher's father, the dentist, had his office, was like one of those boxes for me. When I saw the top, when I saw the clock, tears welled in my eyes. I started to shake. I had trouble breathing. I thought about jumping out of the car onto Ocean Boulevard, where I figured I would be run over and die. The hippocampus and the rest of my temporal lobes must have been working just fine. I was still whimpering in the back of the Cadillac when my mother pulled into the lot. She got out of the car. The parking lot man ripped the yellow sticker apart, handed me half to my brother, and placed the other half under the wiper. As he was doing that, he saw me in the back curl like a petrified rat. He called after my mother, "Hey, lady, you can't leave the kid. They got rules." She paused, nodded, seemed to recall that I was still in the car. She walked back and opened the door. "Richard, you can't stay here. They've got rules." "I'm not going. It's not fair. You never said fine." Then she just turned and started to walk away. I got out of the car. I ran past the parking lot man. I caught up to my mother. "It's not fair." She kept walking. "I hate the dentist." I had to skip jump to keep up. "I really, really do." She kept walking. I caught up again. "But after, can I get a BLT with mayo and toast?" The only good thing about the dentist was that after, I got a bacon, lettuce, and tomato with mayo and toast at Junior's Luncheonette. If it weren't for Junior's, I'd have killed myself long ago on Ocean Parkway. "No," she said. "Why?" I stomped both of my feet, then ran to catch up. "Because we are not going to the dentist." "Thank you." "We're not?" I said, suddenly feeling a lot better. "Then where are we going?" I followed her into the building. 8. She said to the elevator man. He was a black man wearing a dark green suit that said Dime on the collar. He closed the doors. "What's on 8? I asked. Dr. Fisher was on 11. She was staring into the glass like she was staring at something I couldn't see. My mother was beautiful. I'm pretty sure she was beautiful. Sometimes when I didn't have school, like June when it's July or August, she let me play with my shoulders as she got ready to take a bath. My father was at work. My sisters were grown. I loved cowboys. I loved Indians. I loved watching my mother. "You shouldn't let him see you like that," my father said one morning as he left for work, which was in a factory where they made fans. That's what my father did. He went to a factory where they made fans. "Oh, Dave," she said as she kissed him goodbye. "I'm old. What's to see?" She wasn't old. "Mommy, I love cowboys and Indians. My mother had bottles and creams. I'd play just inside the door as she ran the water for her bath. Even though I had more Indians, the cowboys won. That was how it was done." "So what are you doing today?" she asked as she poured something from a purple bottle into the water. The steam rose and clouded the mirror. "What makes it smell like that?" I asked. "Like what?" "Like that," I said. She sat in the chair by the bath. "It's got herbs." I nodded. "Herbs," she said. "What are herbs?" I asked. "Lavender, sage. Those are herbs," she said. "Odors are critical for learning and memory about events and places and constitute efficient retrieval cues for the recall of emotional episodic memory." I'm not going to explain episodic memory, but if you read the book, you'll find out. "Oh," I said, "that's an herb." "Yes," she said, stirring the water with her hand. Maybe you can go fishing, she said. We lived in Manhattan Beach, which was between the ocean where there were waves and Sheepshead Bay where there were fish. Mommy? I asked as she took off her robe. She stood up and lay her robe over the back of the chair. What? Her robe was white. My eyes just followed from the white of the robe on the chair to her hand, to her arm, her shoulder, her back, to her skin. She wasn't wearing any clothes. Richard, Freud would have said it was edible. I would have said it was my mother. Richard, what? What are you doing? Watching. Then she just smiled as she pulled her hair back from her face and held it with a clip. She said, you've seen enough, and stepped into the bath. Go fishing. She said as she lowered herself into the water, and as she did, the smell of herbs rose like fish. Richard, what? Ask Michael. Michael Starr was my best friend who lived around the block next to my cousins, Susan, Margo, and Judy. Now go, I stood there. Go! I gathered my cowboys, my Indians. This time, the Indians won. As I walked out, she was settling in the bath. She seemed kind of pleased. I turned to her and asked, Mommy, are you beautiful? She smiled as she stirred the water. Ask your father, she said. The elevator man moved the crank to the right, then back to the left. 8, he said. And then he opened the metal frame door, and there we were, on 8. My mother didn't move, just kept staring deep into the glass. You did say 8, the elevator man asked. Then she turned to the elevator man and said, yes, thank you. 8. I followed her out. When I looked back, the elevator man was watching. He nodded. I nodded. Right then and there, I knew that when I grew up, I was going to be an elevator man. That's really true. I remember that pretty carefully. I ran to catch up to my mother. She walked down the long stone floor to another door. In the Dime Savings Bank Brooklyn building, every hallway door was made of glass with steel around the sides. She stopped in front of one that said, Dr. David J. Stein, written in black. She stared at the glass. Who's Dr. Stein? I asked. She didn't answer. She just stared. Mommy? I know. What? We went inside. There was no one. No desk, no nurse, no doctor, no one. 2 chairs, a table, a picture on the wall of a train that said, Sud. Another door opposite the one we had come in was dark and brown and old. Is Dr. Stein his dentist? The only other doctor I knew in the Dime Savings Bank in Brooklyn was Dr. Fisher, the dentist. She looked at me as if trying to decide what to say. Then she said, he's a specialist. Oh, I said. She sat down. What's a specialist? I asked. She opened her purse, took out a Kleenex. She blotted her lips, leaving red marks on the white tissue. She tossed the Kleenex into the waste bag next to the chair. A specialist is someone you see when there's nothing wrong. Her purse snapped shut. Or when you're incurable. What does that mean? I asked. She lay her head back and closed her eyes. There were 2 chairs in the room, each against opposite walls. I moved one chair close to where my mother was sitting. For a while, I just stared at the wall with a picture of Sud. Then I said, am I sick? She opened her eyes. Mommy? Her hands were... I wouldn't have been like that. Mommy? Her hands were folded neatly on her lap. I looked around the room. The room was quiet, like a movie, when something bad is about to happen. But nothing was happening, so I asked, Mommy, after I see Dr. Stein, can I get a BLT with mayo and toasted juniors? I waited. Mommy? No. Why not? She didn't say, and then she said, because you're not seeing Dr. Stein. Oh, that also made me feel better. Then what am I doing here? I stared at the old door as if the answer lay just behind, like on one of those TV shows I sometimes watch. If no one was around, I just sneaked down to the basement and turn it on. My father had bought us a Philco. I loved that Philco. So will it be door number 1, door number 2, or door number, but there was only one door, and it was dark and brown and old, the kind of door that would never have a washing machine or a car or a dog behind it. I wanted a dog. I stared at the door trying to figure out what might be behind it when I heard a sound, the kind a door makes, but the door was still closed. I stared at the old dark brown door trying to figure out why it was still closed, and then it opened. I was thinking how that was weird, how first I heard a door open and then the door actually opened, and then I realized 2 doors. Bacon and eggs, a knife, a fork, a spoon, toast, a small pot, a bowl of sugar, heavy cream, a woman, an infant, 2 pats of butter, an empty cup, a knock on the door. May I come in? Dr. Reese asked. having already entered the room. My mother stared at Dr. Reese as if she didn't remember who he was. She smiled weakly. "How did you sleep?" Dr. Reese asked. He asked that question every time he entered the room, even if it was mid-afternoon. "How did you sleep?" was his gambit, followed almost always by, "Have you had anything to eat?" He glanced at the untouched plates of food, having asked a question whose answer was there on the tray, plain as day. "Hospital food," he nodded as he pulled a chair next to her bed. "Some coffee?" She shook her head. "Do you mind if I..." He poured a cup, took a sip. My mother waited. "Ruth, doctors always address patients by their first names." "Ruth," he took another sip, "your baby." Then he coughed, smiled. "This is as bad as what they serve in the cafeteria," he said, amused by the spontaneity of the wit. Dr. William Reese, a psychiatrist, had been asked to evaluate my mother because the nurse was concerned whether my mother was in any condition to be sent home. There were concerns that she might be depressed. There were concerns that she might... "Ruth, infanticide is not unknown with postpartum women who are depressed." "Ruth, yes. Postpartum depression is characterized by depressed mood, tearfulness, anxiety, emotional ability, fatigue, shame, guilt, withdrawal. Psychotic thinking and suicidal ideation are not uncommon. Women with postpartum depression exhibit greater psychomotor retardation and cognitive impairment than those with non-postpartum depression. In their classic study, Why Mothers Die, Lewis and Dreif showed that for the first year postpartum, the greatest number of deaths were by suicide. Suicide attempts by postpartum women are often violent, self-incinerating, jumping, hanging, drowning, throat cutting. Infanticide by women with postpartum depression is usually related to the psychotic process. In that, it was an extraordinary fact that when I learned it, was that the most frequent cause of death in women postpartum is suicide. I mean, it's not hemorrhages, it's not thrombosis, it's not emboli, it's suicide, which is an extraordinary fact. Back to Dr. Reese. "Have you had anything to eat? There were concerns that she might kill me." Not surprisingly, those women with high suicidal ideation were less responsive to their woman's cues than were depressed, non-suicidal mothers. Often those more suicidal mothers were passive and demonstrated helplessness in their interactions with their infants. Often these more suicidal mothers, "Your baby is crying," Dr. Reese said, have been known to be less responsive to verbal utterances and to provide less tactile stimulation. Like a dam that was stressed for want of bedding, too many predators, too little food, my mother was stressed. She sat in the bed propped up on pillows. "He cries all the time," she said. "He's 2 days old," Dr. Roos said. "Postpartum depression is associated with disturbances in the mother-infant relationship, as well as long-term negative consequences for the child in cognitive, behavioral, and social-emotional development." "He cries all the time," she said. "I can't get him to stop." "Why don't you hold him?" he offered. Relationships between depressed mothers and their infants are often characterized by impairments in the process of mutual regulation. For example, as mothers can be disengaged from their infants, talk less, show fewer facial expressions, share less of their attention, less touch. All this suggested an impairment in the early attachment bond, an impairment in the relationship between oxytocin and cortisol that inhibit the mother from forming a bond. Dr. Ruth sat for a few more minutes watching my mother as she struggled with what she should do, with what she imagined he wanted her to do, with what she imagined some other woman would do. He took another sip of coffee. "I can't," she said as she watched me lying there next to her in the bed. Dr. Reese put down the coffee, stood up. "I'll hold him," Dr. Reese said as he picked me up and rocked me back and forth on his chest. Then he sang a song, perhaps one he had sung to his sons when they were just as new. "Hush you by, don't you cry, go to sleep, little baby." I quieted down. My parasympathetic nervous system was responding to his hands, his arms, to the movement of his chest. My parasympathetic nervous system responding to the song, "When you wake, you shall have..." I drooled on his shoulder. "He's quiet," Dr. Reese said. "He needs sleep," my mother said. "He needs you," Dr. Reese said. "The incidence of maternal mental illness is staggering," Dr. Catherine Monk said. "I'm afraid if I hold him, I might drop him." "Ruth, what?" "You won't drop him," Dr. Reese said, returning me to her chest. "Sing to him." I can't," she said. "Ruth, I can't." He moved me a little higher. "I'll let the nurse know." "Know what?" she asked. folding onto her chest, that you won't drop him.
We heard Richard Brockman reading from his book, Life After Death, Surviving Suicide, published in 2023 by Arcade Publishing. He was recorded at Canio's Books in Sag Harbor. Some upcoming readings at Canio's Books include on Saturday, February the 3rd at 5:30 p.m., Poems for World Peace. Invited guest readers share a poem that speaks to the world's yearning for peace. On Saturday, February the 10th at 4:30 p.m., Professor of Religious Studies Tom Petriano leads a discussion of Alexandra Hudson's The Soul of Civility. Details at canyosbooks.com. Today's East End Inc. was produced by Tony Ernst, with the aid of Marianne Callendrell and Catherine Zocher of Canyos Books. This is Hazel Kahn.